Katie, now you're coming to Amsterdam in a few weeks' time, and I was wondering if you, as a British and French person visiting Amsterdam, have been targeted by these much publicised online ads yet, by the city of Amsterdam calling for British groups of lads to stay away from our city.
Are you calling me a lad?
Well, you have displayed some quite laddish behaviours in my many years of knowing you. So I wouldn't be surprised.
It's so rude. Well, if you're asking, have I been Googling best pub crawl Amsterdam for stag weekend? No, I haven't been doing that. So no, I haven't received the warnings. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I guess you can still come to my lovely city. But yeah, there's been quite a hoo-ha this week about this advertising campaign from the city. I don't know if everyone will have seen it, but yeah, it's been quite big news in my niche British Amsterdam circle.
How's it going down? How are people taking it?
I think most people think this is not going to do anything to keep people away. And if anything, it's just going to remind people that Amsterdam is a wild place to go and you can get stoned there. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's even an uptick in groups of British lads coming to Amsterdam.
Oh no, reverse advertising. Maybe this is what they wanted the whole time. I don't think so somehow.
I don't think so either. I've said this on the show before that I feel a bit icky about the idea of like wanting the right kind of tourists in town. But having actually lived in the center of town, I do find the groups of lads that come just to drink, take drugs and maybe visit the red light district don't make the city like a nicer place to live in and probably make it a worse place to live in. But I don't think we should be exclusively vilifying the British ones.
Well, this was my question. Are they all Brits or are they also from elsewhere?
They're definitely not all Brits, but I do have friends who've lived in the red light district who said the Brits are the worst. So, maybe there is some truth in the stereotype.
Oh, dear.
Although last week when I was coming back from Italy, I was surrounded by some groups of Dutch lads who were also pretty rowdy and antisocial. So let's just all like agree to try and be nice and respectful to the places we're visiting.
Okay.
You included. Anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time in the flesh. Have you been in the meantime?
I've been good, thank you. I went to watch the Paris Marathon this weekend. My sister-in-law, Aislinn, was running. She is a machine. Congratulations to her and everyone else who put their bodies through this insanity. But I think I've worked out how to do the marathon in the way that I enjoy.
Oh, yeah?
And it involves sitting in a bistro along the route, eating French fries and just sort of enjoying the view of all of these people working really hard and cheering intermittently. But it was pretty great. I had a lovely time and I didn't have to run at all.
That sounds like my kind of marathon.
It was very civilized. Marathons and lads aside, what are we talking about this week?
This week, we're going to be discussing so-called sustainable investments. There are currently about 4.2 trillion euros invested in Europe in funds that claim to be green in one way or another. But how green are those funds really? Well, spoiler alert, according to a huge piece of research, a lot of that money is being invested in places that really aren't green at all. So we wanted to find out a bit more about how that is happening and what we could do to ensure that our savings are being invested in places that are helping the world become a better place. So we invited one of the journalists involved in this great green investment investigation, Daniele Grasso, an Italian data journalist based in Madrid. He'll be joining us later on in the show. But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
It's been a bad week for Sanna Marin, the Prime Minister of Finland, who was defeated in last weekend's general election in Finland. The 37-year-old leader pretty gracefully conceded defeat, I thought, saying democracy is always a wonderful thing. Mm. And she said that despite the fact that her party actually came third in the election. It was a very narrow third, but still third. So her party, the centre-left Social Democrats, got 19.9% of the vote. And the populist Finns party inched ahead with 20.1%. Oof. And above them, the winning party was the right-wing National Coalition Party, who eked 20.8% of the vote. So less than 1% between the top three parties. An incredibly close race for that top spot.
Yikes, that is super, super close, isn't it? Are people interpreting this as a rejection of Sanna Marin's leadership personally, or is it more about policies? What's going on there?
Actually, it's not so much being interpreted as a rejection of Sanna Marin, because if anything, it's the opposite. According to opinion polls, Marin is more popular than her party as a whole. Mm-hmm. Of course, most people outside of Finland know about Sanna Marin because of the media storm around those videos that were leaked last summer of her partying with her friends. Partying that her critics claimed was irresponsible, and some critics also threw unfounded accusations at her that were later proven wrong, that she had been taking drugs. But that whole dancing story actually possibly helped her, at least with some part of the population who saw her as just like a normal person that wants to let go sometimes. She was also praised by many in and outside of Finland for leading Finland's pivot towards NATO membership. And there is a bit of bittersweet timing for Marin this week with that issue, because whilst the road to NATO membership has been a long and tortuous one, it will almost certainly reach its endpoint by the time you are listening to this episode on Thursday. Finland will become the latest country to join NATO. But it's worth pointing out that that NATO achievement didn't really help Marin so much in this election, as it was something that pretty much all the major parties agreed upon, and therefore it didn't end up being an important election issue. Mm. And despite Marin's popularity, which is probably even more cemented abroad than at home in Finland, she didn't win this election. Her party came in third, and Finnish experts I've been reading pointed to two interesting reasons for that. One is that Finns seem to get really antsy about public debt.
Oh, yeah.
And that public debt has been consistently growing since the economic crash of 2008. Not being able to get that under control was something that the opposition parties hammered her coalition government with, even if the previous governments also haven't been able to get that under control. And the other interesting thing I read is that it's almost a rule that sitting Finnish prime ministers lose support in elections. But Marin's party, despite coming third, actually grew in support this time. And it is only the third time that's happened since the Second World War in Finland. So she could be celebrating. The only thing is, unfortunately for her, the two main opposition parties grew significantly more than her party did, largely at the expense of the other parties in her centre-left coalition.
So who's actually going to be prime minister then?
Well, the election was won by the National Coalition Party. They are led by Petteri Orpo, a 53-year-old man who has had various government positions before, most notably Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance. Where Marin is personally more popular than her party, Orpo has the opposite. He is less popular than his party. Bad luck, Orpo. Aww. But as the election winner, he will be the person that gets the first stab at trying to form a coalition, as is traditional in Finland. And if he does indeed become prime minister, he will be the first leader of his party to be prime minister since former guest of this show, Alex Stubb, who Orpo actually challenged for the leadership back in 2016.
And how likely is it that he will actually become prime minister? Like, is it going to be fairly easy for him to form a coalition or not so much?
I don't think it's going to be that easy. He has two directions he can go in. The direction that appears a bit less likely is heading left and opting to work with Sanna Marin's Social Democrats. It appears a bit more likely that he'll opt to work with the anti-immigration Eurosceptic populists, the Finns, who came second and won their best ever result in a Finnish election. But with either of those parties, they would need at least a third party to reach a majority, and possibly a fourth. And any of those possible coalitions would have to end up with some pretty strange bedfellows ruling together in coalition. So everything is still up in the air, and there is a not totally impossible chance that Marin actually gets an opportunity to try to form a coalition herself if Orpo fails. So we'll be watching what's going on in Finland closely.
We will indeed.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
It has been a good week for humans in the battle to stop the robots taking over. I'm talking about a news story that you may have seen this week, which is Italy's decision to ban ChatGPT, the world's most talked about artificial intelligence tool. Twitter was full of jokes over the weekend about why Italy's data protection agency made this decision. And a lot of these tweets had screenshots of what happens when you ask this chatbot if it's acceptable to put pineapple on a pizza. And ChatGPT kept responding like, sure, you can put pineapple on pizza. Why not? This is not actually why Italy has banned the chatbot, though. It's a little bit more serious than that.
So why are Italy banning ChatGPT?
Two main reasons. The first is that Italy's data protection agency, which is called the Garante, they have accused the company that makes ChatGPT, OpenAI, they've accused this company of not properly protecting people's personal data. And it's quite hard to argue with that. There was a bug in the program last month, and for 9 hours, a bunch of people's names and bank card details got leaked, and also details of the questions that people had been asking the chatbot. So that's not great. The other thing that the Garante, this agency, is saying is that ChatGPT doesn't have any kind of age verification system in place. Anyone with an email address can sign up, essentially. So there's nothing stopping kids from using it and getting exposed to illicit or otherwise inappropriate answers. And that's something that the Italian regulators take really seriously. You might be aware that they've cracked down quite heavily on TikTok in recent years. In fact, you talked about it, Dominic, on the podcast a couple of years back. More recently, Italy banned a chatbot called Replica that is billed as a kind of virtual friend. But a lot of people have been using that particular service to generate erotic conversations. That chatbot was banned in Italy in February, again on the grounds of child safety, among other issues.
Am I right in thinking that Italy are the first country in the world to ban ChatGPT?
Yeah, there's a few other countries around the world where ChatGPT isn't available: China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran. But that's because OpenAI, the company behind it, has chosen not to make it available in those countries. Italy is the first country where it's a public authority that has made the move to ban it. But it might not be the last country. And that is because one of the things the Italian watchdog said is that it's worried that ChatGPT is in breach of everyone's favorite piece of European data regulation, the GDPR. And under this regulation, if the company involved doesn't have a legal entity here, and in this case it doesn't, we're talking about a San Francisco-based company with no official offshoot incorporated in a European country, because that's the case, any data protection agency in an EU country can look at this chatbot and say, looks like the data of people in this country is at risk. We're going to follow Italy's lead and ban it until we're confident that the personal information of, Germans or Latvians or Greeks is definitely safe.
Maybe stupid question, but ChatGPT, it takes information off the internet, right? And answers people's questions using that data. Can we think of that data that they collect on the internet as people's personal information?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it doesn't really have a clear answer as yet. But there is an argument that we can think about some of this stuff as personal data. And to give one example that I have borrowed from TechCrunch, who wrote a really good article about this, I'll link to it in the show notes. TechCrunch gave the example of personal biographies of individual people that ChatGPT can generate for you. And it writes these potted biographies based off information taken from the internet. We don't actually know what data the latest version of the chatbot has been trained on. But we do know that previous versions have used data taken from internet forums, like Reddit, for example. And that means that if you are an individual person with some kind of online presence, not necessarily a famous person, just a person, the chatbot probably knows some information about you, and it will grab information that could be considered to be personal information. And purely for illustrative purposes, I hope you don't mind, but I asked the chatbot to write a little biography of you, Dominic.
Oh,
would you like to know what it says?
No, that's really horrible.
Well, I'm doing it anyway. All right, here we go. Dominic Kramer is a multi-talented artist known for his beautiful voice as an opera singer and his insightful commentary as a co-host of the popular podcast, The Europeans.
That's actually quite flattering. Thank you.
Born in Germany,
oh,
Kramer developed a passion for music at an early age. He began singing in choirs as a child, correct, I think.
Yeah.
And later studied vocal performance at the Hochschule für Musik und Tanz in Cologne.
Oh, I mean, where did that come from? I don't think I've ever been to Cologne.
After completing his studies, he embarked on a successful career as an opera singer, performing in renowned theatres and festivals throughout Europe. And then it goes on to talk about how your warm and charismatic presence has helped to make this podcast a worldwide hit. I mean, as you say, like, most of it is very flattering, but some bits of that are wrong, aren't they?
Yeah, some of the details are wrong, but obviously all the like subjective things are absolutely correct.
Of course they are. And I mean, look, it's not the biggest problem in the world if this bot thinks that you were born in Germany and studied in Cologne. But, you know, imagine if it said something offensive about you or something that damaged your reputation. And the fact is that ChatGPT frequently writes things that are false, as if they are facts. Like, it gets stuff wrong all the time. And under GDPR, this much-loved piece of regulation that we have here protecting our data in Europe, we Europeans are lucky to have a bunch of rights over our data, including the right to ask for our personal information to be fixed if it appears wrongly online. And right now, it's not clear if you can ask OpenAI to fix the information about you. I honestly wouldn't know how you would go about that. Mm. So this could actually end up being quite a consequential decision by Italy, at the very least, because other regulators around Europe are now also going to look at ChatGPT and see what they think of it. Ireland, for example, has already said that they're going to do that, and others are probably going to follow.
Are ChatGPT going to be like permanently banned in Italy, or have the regulators left some room for the people behind ChatGPT to like sort some of the problems out?
Yeah, it's just a temporary ban for now. So OpenAI has 20 days to provide a bunch of additional information that the Garante has asked for. And the company are supposed to offer solutions to the problems that the watchdog has identified if they want the service to be unblocked in Italy. And if the company doesn't address the concerns, it could be fined either 4% of its turnover or 20 million euros, whichever one is bigger. Mm. So there's some pretty serious penalties involved. For now, though, OpenAI have simply blocked the chatbot for use in Italy. They've said that the company is committed to protecting people's privacy. And for all it's worth, it says it believes that it does comply with GDPR and other privacy laws. So I guess we'll see in about 3 weeks' time what happens with this. But I think it's being watched pretty closely, and not just in Europe. I mean, governments all over the world are battling with the same policy questions around this technology. Like, what the hell are we supposed to do with it? Universities are suddenly having to deal with the idea that students can just turn in essays written by a chatbot. Journalists are being replaced at some news organizations by AI, even though it writes really boringly and gets stuff wrong, as we've seen. It's upending all kinds of industries already, and no one's really sure what to do with it.
I kind of find it a bit surprising that it's on this data protection issue that Italy have decided to ban it, because I feel like there are just so many potential risks. I mean, there was this letter from all these tech experts saying, urging the developers of GPT to like put the brakes on because we're not ready for it yet. Mm. I'm just a bit scared in general of it.
I mean, I guess if you want to look on the bright side, I think the Italian ruling shows that we do have some existing legal tools for trying to figure this out here in Europe, at least. And it will be really interesting to see if they are enough. I suspect that they won't be. There's a lot of good reasons to think that they won't be. So, I mean, again, on the bright side, I guess you could say it's a good thing that Europe is working on a new artificial intelligence law, which we talked about briefly last week. Mm. But that probably won't be law until after the robots have come and properly destroyed civilization as we know it.
Huge thanks to all the wonderful people who are supporting this independent podcast of ours on Patreon. Do you like that we make it, and would you like to help ensure that we keep making it? Well, if the answer to both those questions is yes, please head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast, and you can support the show with as little as €2 a month, and it makes a huge difference.
This week, a big, big thank you goes to our latest very generous supporters, Paul O'Shea, Gio Mercian, and Maria Cristina Martinez. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You know, I often find myself thinking, you know, I've had a very productive week and I have cleaned my apartment and I have eaten my vegetables, but I haven't done anything nice for anyone. And I think signing up to support this podcast is like a really easy and convenient way to like get your generous, kind thing done for the week so that you can be mean and grumpy for the rest of the week. Is that good advice?
Great advice.
Okay. Those of you who heard the end of last week's episode would have heard me announcing that we were talking about libraries this week. A slight change of plan. We're going to talk about libraries next week, but you'll be very glad to hear that we are talking about something just as fascinating today. Money. Filthy money. Well, actually, I guess that's the question, really. Like, does money need to be filthy? Does capitalism need to be unethical and generally terrible? In recent years, a trend has emerged of investment funds trumpeting their green credentials and basically saying, you can have it all. Like, if you give us your money, we will turn it into more money, but also you'll be able to sleep at night because you'll be safe in the knowledge that your cash has been invested in sustainable companies that are fighting the good fight and trying to transition us to a cleaner economy. Which sounds great, doesn't it?
Sounds lovely. Yeah, then I feel like I could be grumpy all week.
Except, oh wait, as usual, things aren't quite as amazing as they seem. These kinds of investment funds are regulated by a piece of EU regulation called the European Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation. Catchy. And the supposedly most eco-friendly of the funds can declare themselves to be Article 9 funds. They're sometimes also called dark green funds. These are, in theory, the funds that only invest people's money in sustainable assets. Except when a huge team of journalists across Europe got together to actually look at these funds, they found that nearly half of them invest in fossil fuels or aviation. You can also find in this category funds that invest in fast fashion giants like H&M, which, you know, despite their branding efforts, can hardly be seen as beacons of sustainability. Something has clearly gone very, very wrong here. What is going on? How can we fix it? To find out, we spoke to one of the journalists involved in the project, Daniele Grasso. He is a data journalist working in Madrid for El País newspaper. This idea of sustainable or eco-friendly investments is an idea that's been massively gaining in popularity in the financial world over the past few years. Can you give us an idea of how much money is going into these supposedly more ethical funds these days?
Well, to give you an idea, I can tell you that in Europe alone, investors right now are investing 4.2 trillion euros in funds that promise a sustainable world. It's like 60 times Google's revenue in a year. It's really a lot of money, and it's going each year a bit more interesting for investors. The greenest funds doubled their value in the last 2 years. So it's totally a hype with this type of investments.
It was really striking to read in your reporting that funds have been classifying themselves as green, even when they're investing in airlines or a fossil fuel giant. Is it that there are simply loopholes, or is there some strange environmental argument for investing in an airline or the like?
Well, that is actually the core of the whole investigation. How is this all possible, you know? And it all came from the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, that is this regulation that the European Commission developed in 2019. It's true that they were entering uncharted territories somehow. They were trying to make a container for what is a sustainable investment, how the financial market should work, and it's totally something that they never did before. It's also true that the Commission itself know that they were putting like some minimal standards to start a long process, etc. So the nature of a sustainable fund, it was no longer simply nominal. Before it was, I'm green because I say that I'm green, so there were no label. But rather depends on a compliance with regulatory requirements. But then the problem was how this was applied. Basically, when the SFDR, this regulation was approved, it was not so clear how you could measure that the fund was really a green investment or not a green investment. So they have the label, they didn't have the regulatory standards to make those labels really reliable.
And if I understand correctly, there's this idea built into the regulation that if, for example, a fossil fuel giant is investing money in transitioning towards renewables, that could still be included in the most green category of investment, even though it's a fossil fuel company, right?
Yeah, actually, the regulation doesn't say it's totally prohibited to invest in fossil fuel. There is no phrase where they say you cannot invest in fossil fuel. They try to make it super hard for funds to invest in fossil fuel, because actually what the regulation does is make the funds declare everything that they invest in. So there is no exact definition of what or where they can or cannot invest. And that is a big issue. And as we told with regulators and also with fund asset managers, that is mainly the biggest issue.
Now, I know you're not a financial advisor, so apologies in advance for asking you this question, but did you get any sense of why banks still want to invest in hugely polluting companies like Total? I mean, for example, solar has become the cheapest energy source of all time, and I would have thought it's a good investment. So is it really less risky to invest in a sector that the world is planning to scale down in favor of one that is reliably growing?
Well, we should ask this to the banks themselves. Actually, it's true that the world is slowly scaling down from fossil fuels. It's also true that in Europe, in OECD Europe, from countries where we have data, production from renewables energy took the lead over fossil fuels only 3 years ago. So we are like in this transitional period. I think that it's true that when you speak to asset managers from the banks, some of them, at least they know that the path is there, the path for investing in renewable energies and not in fossil fuel is there, but they want to go, you know, slowly, because there is a lot of risk in the regulations, how they're going to be. For example, here in Spain, in the last 2 or 3 years, thousands of solar plants were approved, but they still have to be built. So, you know, it's there, everything is ready, but we didn't make the transition yet. So I think that is part of the answer, at least.
And speaking of Spain, I mean, this reporting has made waves across the banking world, but what has the response to this investigation been like where you are?
Well, there are no really big fund managers in Spain. The biggest in Europe are in France, in UK, and in Germany. But the financial regulators is quite strict. And they told after the investigation they were going to take a deep investigation into the consistency of the information that the funds were giving to them. So we still don't know the result of this investigation. They said me it was going to take at least 6 months in reviewing all the funds. So I think before summer we will know something. But it was interesting that they were not totally surprised when we sent them our questions. It was like, yeah, we know that there are some issues. We are actually taking care of this somehow, but thanks to your investigation, we're going to take a deeper look into these concrete funds.
Must be quite a satisfying response. I hope they do look into it properly. Looking more broadly across Europe, has there been much pressure since your investigation for investment companies to be more honest about where the money in these supposedly eco-friendly funds is going?
A few big funds decided to declassify their funds, to take out the Article 9 label from some of their funds. For example, Amundi, that is a French fund manager, they declassified 100 funds. And it was interesting because this happened 2 or 3 days before our publication, and actually a week after we called them, saying to them the results of our investigation. So actually, as in every reporting, we had to ask them their point of view, and so they decided to make this move.
And what about the regulation itself? Is that being tightened up to make it less easy to just say, oh yeah, yeah, we're super green, when actually you're not?
Not for the moment, although at the beginning of December, a couple of weeks after the publication of the investigation, there was in the European Commission a whole debate about the investigation, actually, and the greenwashing in the finance world, and the results of our investigation were brought there. Also, it's interesting, something that was already taken into account in the law. Actually, in January 2023, 2 months ago, started a new phase of the European regulation that require answering a series of detailed questions to measure the real impact of each sustainable investment. So this stuff that they weren't actually measuring anything, they were just saying, okay, we are green. Actually, right now, they have to start measuring. It's a step forward to go in the right direction, I think.
If you're someone who has some cash to invest and you want to do good with it, is there actually a fund that you discovered that you feel you could be safe putting money in? Or after seeing how murky and messed up these pots of money can get, do you think it's better to just invest directly in an individual company that you think is doing good work?
I think that is so difficult to answer also because in the financial world and this in sustainable investment finance world, there is this elephant in the room, and that is that there is no good data to understand exactly how each one of these funds works. So, for example, it takes months of investigation from 20 journalists to understand that these funds are investing in non-sustainable companies. How is this possible? That there is no transparency in this world, and I think that is the biggest problem. So without this transparency from the funds, in my case, I'd better invest directly in an individual company because I think it's more transparent normally.
Daniele was part of a big, big team that investigated these investment funds for loads of different media outlets, including his own newspaper El País, Le Monde here in France, and many, many others. A great place to start, if you're interested in this, is to read the version of the investigation published by the Dutch website Follow the Money, who helped to coordinate the reporting. It's in English and it is super clearly laid out, and you will find a link to that in the show notes. And if you scroll to the bottom of the piece, you will find reporting on the same story in many other languages. What have you been enjoying this week?
Well, I feel like I should caveat my recommendation here with the fact that I am a naive Northern European with apparently a very limited culinary experience. So some of you may laugh at me for even mentioning this as something special, but when I was in Italy for a few weeks, I discovered the delights of courgette flowers.
Oh.
It was that an O is like, oh, you idiot. Like, how can you even talk about courgette flowers as something special? Or,
well, then I feel like that makes me sound snobby that you haven't eaten courgette flowers, but you can get them here in France quite easily. So they're, yeah, a tasty thing. I feel sad for you that you've only just discovered them.
Yeah, well, I really hadn't seen them ever in a Dutch supermarket, but I'm going to look a bit closer. I hope I will be able to at least find them when they're in season over the summer. They were everywhere in supermarkets in Bolzano, and my husband cooked them for me a few times, and I thought they were totally delicious. I didn't even do the cooking, but there are lots of different things you can do with them. And I thought I'd recommend one thing that he did that I just thought was so delicious. He just simply fried them with garlic butter and some oats because Ooh. We didn't have any breadcrumbs, and the oats worked. It was so tasty, and they've got like quite a surprisingly rich taste for a flower, and people often stuff them with ricotta, which I'm sure is also delicious, but even unstuffed, they're excellent. So look out for them wherever you are if you don't eat them regularly already, because I think they are great.
I like that. We should have more edible isolation inspirations on this show.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I really enjoyed last week's episode of 99% Invisible. Have you heard it yet?
No, I haven't. What's that about?
Yeah, wait, so what are those podcasts in general that I used to be super addicted to and then kind of forgot about because there are so many other things that I want to listen to? But I've got back into it recently. And last week's episode comes from a producer called Tatiana Kim. She is from the far east of Russia, but she moved to the Netherlands last year to the city of Breda. Have you been to Breda?
I have been to Breda a few times, yes.
Have you been to the strangely beautiful prison in Breda?
No, I can't say I have.
I should say it's an ex-prison. It closed as a prison back in 2014, and now it's used for like concerts and wine tastings and stuff.
Oh.
But it was built as a panopticon. You know, this very famous, quite disturbing idea for a prison design, where the prison is circular.
Oh, yeah.
So the guards can, like, watch the prisoners from the center and keep them all under surveillance at all time. Anyway, Tatiana, in this episode, uses the fact that she has recently moved to the city and discovered this building as a kind of jumping off point for a whole episode about prison design and how people's thinking on how prisons should be designed has evolved, like how societies initially started experimenting with ideas like solitary confinement and then keeping people in cells. It's an episode that is partly about this one prison in Breda, but it's also quite a pan-European episode. It brings in everything from Dutch architecture to Alexis de Tocqueville, the French philosopher. And I learned a lot from this episode and also found it quite creepy. I think it's very much worth a listen.
This week, there was one European news story that made me particularly happy. It was news from the municipality of Ostelsheim in southwest Germany, where they held an election for mayor last week, and it was won by a 29-year-old man called Ryan Alschebel, who in 2015 arrived in Germany as a refugee escaping Syria. I found it really quite inspiring to hear how someone who arrived in the country so recently has established themselves so quickly in Germany, learned German, and decided to dedicate their professional life to public service of the place that's taken him in. And the fact that he won the support of the voters of Ostelsheim is also really heartening. He said himself that it set an example for broad-mindedness and cosmopolitanism for the whole of Germany. So congrats, Ryan.
Oh, congrats. What a lovely story. Next week, we are actually talking about libraries for real this time. And you will find that episode in your feeds as ever next Thursday.
You can find us on social media in the meantime, on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, or go check out our website, EuropeansPodcast.com.
You can also email us with ideas, suggestions, praise, and complaints at hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Don't encourage the complaints.
Praise would be better. But we can go to ChatGPT for praise.
It's true.
The show was produced this week by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you, Wojciech.
Thank you both.
See you next week, everyone.
Hevasti.
Bye.